Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's Mahler time all over the world this year, the 150th anniversary of the great conductor and composer's birth. Symphonies all over, playing more Mahler than ever. In his time, he often felt misunderstood, said he wished he could have conducted his fifth symphony 50 years after his death. Well, that time has come. These days, he's a bigger box office draw than Beethoven. This hour On Point, the complicated life and music of Gustav Mahler. You can join the conversation. Are you moved by Mahler? How? What is it about Mahler's music that drives some to tears and others just plain crazy? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us now from London is Norman Lebrecht, critic, prominent cultural commentator, and surely one of the world's biggest Mahler enthusiasts. He's a lifetime scholar of Gustav Mahler and his music. His new book is Why Mahler? How One Man and Ten Symphonies Changed Our World. Norman Lebrecht, thank you very much for being here. Welcome to On Point.
It's a pleasure to be in Boston. Almost.
Almost. Just a little Atlantic in between.
That's right.
You've got some great claims for a great composer. You start right off, just to give an example of what you mean by change the world, with an anecdote from 1991 about Mikhail Gorbachev. Remind us of that.
Well, if you remember, Mikhail Gorbachev went through the whole process of trying to reform the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. And at a certain point, there was a counter coup against him by hardline communists. Mm-hmm. And he was held hostage in the Crimea in a villa without contact to the outside world. And at this bit, his wife was having a breakdown in the next room. They weren't allowed to have contact between them. But what there was in the room was a record library. And he found Mahler's Fifth Symphony, which we just heard. Mm. And it touched him in ways that he couldn't explain to himself. It was music that he'd never heard before, and yet it was extraordinarily familiar. It seemed to feel to him both as though it was the music of his life, the soundtrack to his life, and that it somehow expressed the conflicts through which he and Russia was going at that particular moment. And towards the end of the year, when he was about to be deposed by Boris Yeltsin, he went to see a concert of that same symphony by Claudio Abbado in Moscow, and his wife said it moved her to despair. Gorbachev said, no, this isn't despair. This is actually the reality. This is how music brings us in contact with the real stuff of our lives and our history.
Gorbachev saying, writing, I had the feeling, the Russian, Soviet then Russian leader, wrote that Mahler's music somehow touched our situation about the period of perestroika with all its passions and struggles. And right there, within that marriage, you have these two responses to Mahler. You know, Raisa, his wife, driven to despair, and he's saying, no, this gets right to the heart of the great affairs that I'm in the midst of.
Exactly. And this is a century after the composer is gone, and a composer who knew nothing of communism, knew nothing of Soviet Russia, nothing of Bolshevism, and yet he seems so immediate. The question I ask is, why Mahler? Why is it that a composer derided in his lifetime, neglected for decades afterwards, returns to the center of our culture to displace Beethoven and to speak to us as if he's our contemporary? Why Mahler? Is that about him, or is it about us, what we read into him? And that's been a question that I've been wrestling with for about half my life.
I'm looking at a photograph of the great man himself, conductor of fabulous and composer. He looks very contemporary. It looks like he could sit down at a cafe in New York or London today. You say derided and neglected. We'll have listeners who know this music and his history very intimately and others who may never have heard him before. Give us a sense of his biography and where the derided and neglected comes in.
He's born in a nowhere land. He's born in the borderlands of Bohemia and Moravia in the middle of what was then the Austrian Empire and is now the Czech Republic. Mm-hmm. His family were Jews. They had no rights of residence. They weren't allowed to live in a town. If they went to the town, they had to pay a fine on entry and be gone by nightfall. There's a history of oppression and a history of outsiders behind him. And as he begins his career, as he starts conducting in small towns and gradually into larger towns, and he's making his way in the world, he faces both hostility of anti-Semitism and complete incomprehension of what he's trying to do, because Mahler, from the very first notes of his first symphony, is out to change the world. The first symphony opens with the simplest of notes, A, almost a tuning sound on open strings, and for the first 4.5 minutes, you get no theme. He's delivering a soundscape that is quite beyond the comprehension of the people of his time, and he often said, I'm a man not of my own time, my time will come. But he was relating to the whole of music and the whole of European and Western culture as an outsider looking in and setting out to change it.
He also said that he described early on this permanent sense of exile, always an intruder, never welcomed. Here's that first symphony, first movement. This is the Los Angeles Philharmonic, Gustavo Dudamel. This is sometimes called the Titan. And Gustav Mahler, first symphony, first movement. First symphony, first movement. If you don't get shivers there, you are immune to Mahler. Norman Lebrecht is with us. His new book is Why Mahler, How One Man and Ten Symphonies Changed Our World. He joins us from London. And Norman, we've got callers coming in already. Let's go to Nashville, Tennessee. Lewis, you're on the air with Norman Lebrecht.
Hi, Lewis.
Hi, Lewis. What do you think? What do you hear?
Well, I've always had a struggle to believe in a supreme being and divinity, the everything, and I found the answer listening to the Mahler's Fifth Symphony. Any music such as that has to come from somewhere, like a supreme being.
Certainly somewhere outside of ourselves, Lewis, yeah. Well, I mean, what are we listening to now? We're listening to the opening of the First Symphony. What does it suggest to you? Can you picture what this is? Because this isn't a composer who's telling stories. What is it?
I feel that Mahler, in any of his music, goes outside of the known world, the known daily struggles, and he's on a plane that it's just spiritual.
Lewis, I'm so glad for your call.
You're so right here, Lewis. Let me give you a little clue as to what this is. Picture a small boy, 5, 6 years old, who is so terrified at home that he runs away. And where does he run? To the most terrifying place of all, to the heart of the forest, the place which is where he's been warned about. There are wolves, there are witches, they're going to turn you into a gingerbread house. He goes to this forest, and he sits there all day long on a log, and he listens. And that's what we're hearing at the beginning of the First Symphony. The awareness that music is not necessarily tune and rhythm and big noise. Music is all the noises around us, the ones that comfort us and the ones that threaten us, that the world is music.
Norman, Lewis follows this to a comprehension of a supreme being. Did Mahler see music as that kind of pathway?
Mahler, I think, saw his life as a search for God. There are several of his colleagues and contemporaries and friends who said that he was looking to find the meaning of life and the meaning of God. He had that very, very strong religious impulse without necessarily subscribing to any particular faith.
Here he was. For Lewis, it sounds like a world changer. You say he changed our world.
Yeah.
We'll talk about that. We've just got a bit before the break, but give us a sample. Changed our world? How?
Changed, well, first of all, in the very simplest terms here, of the concert experience, Mahler, in the First Symphony, is not delivering what audiences had heard before. It wasn't a frontal assault from the stage. Mahler is delivering music from all over the place. He's saying to listeners, what you're hearing is not just what the musicians are playing, but it's all the noises around. And to show you that, I'm going to send up in my second symphony, I'm going to send musicians out onto the outer balconies from which they're going to blow the resurrection. I'm going to put musicians outside the hall. I'm going to put 1,000 musicians in the hall. Can you imagine? More than any stage on earth can handle. And I want you to feel that music is not the whole thing that you are hearing.
We're going to get very grand with Norman Gustav Mahler this hour. Norman Lebrecht is with us from London. We've got a break right here. Norman, the new book is Why Mahler. We'll hear much more music in this hour. And listeners, you can join us. Has Mahler changed your world? Are you a Mahler maniac, the opposite? And what is it about Gustav Mahler music that sets it apart? 800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK. Here, Second Symphony, Fifth Movement. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is Chicago Symphony Chorus and Symphony Orchestra. And this is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the life and music of Gustav Mahler in the 150th anniversary year of his birth. Behind us right now, a vinyl recording of the first movement of Mahler's Third Symphony, conducted by Raphael Kubelik, performed by the Bavarian Radio Symphony Orchestra in 1967. Norman Lebrecht joins us from London, author of the new Why Mahler, How One Man and Ten Symphonies Changed Our World. I should say right here, I give a special thanks to the Boston University Music Library for providing a lot of the music we're hearing on the show today. You can join the show. Has Mahler changed your world? Do you hear a 19th century Jew in anti-Semitic Vienna struggling in this work, transcending? Do you hear prophecy in this music of the hard 20th century to come? What do you make of Norman Lebrecht's take on Mahler? We're at 800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK. Norman Lebrecht, tell us about this Third Symphony.
Well, what we've just heard is something that's vaguely familiar, and it's the beginning of Mahler's Second Revolution. That blast from the horns was something very sour and a little bit ominous, and we know that tune from somewhere, don't we? Where have we heard that tune before? Can we bring up this other extract of where everybody knows that tune from?
Yes, we can. We have Brahms' First Symphony, Fourth Movement.
Exactly. Let's hear it. Let's hear it.
Okay, this is Brahms' First Symphony, Fourth Movement. Listen, and we'll get Norman to make the connection. Brahms.
Thank you.
Yes, of course, there's Brahms, and everybody knows that, Norman LaBrush. Make the connection to what we just heard on vinyl from Gustav Mahler.
From Gustav Mahler. Well, it's the same theme, isn't it? But it's turned into the minor, and it's blasted out by sour horns. Now, what on earth is Mahler doing here? What he's doing is he's using a literary device called irony, in which he's taking a familiar object and subverting it, giving it another meaning. Now, what's the meaning that he's giving? He's not attacking Brahms in any way. He can't afford to attack Brahms. Brahms is one of his few allies in Vienna, one of the few people he can rely upon to get him a decent job. So he doesn't want to attack Brahms, but he knows what the origin of that big tune in Brahms was. It's one of the most famous tunes in Europe. It's called Beethoven's Tenth. It's the arrival of the next big composer after Beethoven. Mahler knows that this is a nationalist student song that Brahms has used. The words are, I've given myself with heart and with hand to you, my German fatherland. And Mahler, by turning it into the minor and turning it really sour, is saying, to who, my German fatherland? To the German fatherland that won't let me join your student fraternities because I'm a Jew? To the German fatherland that won't allow my people full citizenship or rights of residence? To the German fatherland that ignores and persecutes all of its minorities? Beginning of the Third Symphony is Mahler using music for the first time in history as social and political protest.
Let's go back to that.
Let's hear it again.
Tell us why we listen. We'll go back again. You heard the Brahms. Back to Mahler, Third Symphony, first movement. That sour response, Norman LaBrush says, to what Mahler may have heard around him. Tell us about how anti-Semitism played out in his own life, Norman.
It was pretty severe. For many years, he couldn't get a proper job, and he was shunted around the provinces. And every time they came back to him and they said, "We're not going to employ you. You're a Jew. We don't want you." In order to get a job as fifth conductor in the Vienna Opera at the age of 37, and this at a time when he is already famous across half of Europe, he has to convert to Catholicism, which he does with great reluctance. And then within a matter of months, he rises to become director of the Vienna Opera. But from the day he sets foot in Vienna, the newspapers are full of phrases like, let's see what antics this Jew boy performs in the podium, and we're ready for him. We're going to take him down a few pegs. So it was an undercurrent. It was a chorus to the whole of his life. But he didn't view it in a particularist manner as, oh, I'm a Jew, they're out to get me. He actually looked at society as a whole and said, what is society made up of? There is a majority and there are lots of minorities. And all of these minorities, all of these outsiders, are being shut out from the mainstream of music. I, Gustav Mahler, am going to bring them back in. And that's something that he does in the Fourth Symphony, the next one along, where he does the most extraordinary thing at the opening of the second movement. He tells the concertmaster, in the score, he says, put down your expensive violin. I want you to pick up a gypsy fiddle tuned one tone higher than the rest of the strings and play like one of those travellers that you hear in the streets. Now imagine the impact of that on the middle-class audience in Munich and Vienna when he gave the premiere in 1897-1901. He is bringing the unmentionable into the concert hall. The gypsy, the people who live outside the law, the people who, legend has it, are going to steal your children. Mahler brings this right into the heart of the concert hall and says, you're not alone here. You're not the majority. Society is much more complex than you know. It's a very, very modern message.
Yeah, very modern and a very powerful message. At the same time, this is a very complex man. You're taking us back here at 1897, as you say, that the conversion to Christianity forced on him as a condition of taking the post as director of the State Opera in Vienna. But then I'm reading here from a letter to what, Ludwig Karpath, and mm-hmm. Mahler's writing, in fact, it was my longing to escape from the hell of Hamburg that prompted me to contemplate the idea of having to leave the Jewish community. That is the humiliating part of it. I do not deny that it cost me a great effort. Indeed, one could say, he writes, it was an instinct of self-survival that prompted me to such an action. And then he says, inwardly, I was not averse to the idea at all. What does that mean, Norman LeBrecht?
What it means is this is a man with a very broad cultural outlook. As a boy, as a Jewish boy, he not only sang in synagogue, he also sang in the Catholic Church because he had a lovely voice and they let him sing there. So wow. He had an appreciation of Christian and Roman Catholic liturgy. He didn't mind joining the mainstream, but he never forgot where he came from, and he never stopped fighting for the rights of minorities. Now, what I'm giving you here mm-hmm. is a contemporary and rather radical interpretation of who Mahler was and what he did. But it seems to me that this kind of interpretation helps explain why Mahler has attained this astonishing popularity in the 21st century. He seems to be addressing all of these issues that are part of our lives. And I know, can say for myself, when I came to Mahler, I was in my late 20s, and I started listening to the music, and it was very strange, and I was reading about the life, and suddenly it dawned on me that this is somebody who was dealing with things in my life, with things I knew about, with racism, with workplace chaos, with social conflict, with relationships and breakdown and alienation, depression, limitations of medical knowledge, everything that a young man just starting out on his career is contending with. It's all there in Mahler.
Let's listen to a little bit from the Fourth Symphony. This is the opening of the second movement. Concertmaster switches to a fiddle tuned to a kind of sound evocative of gypsy music. Vienna Philharmonic, Gustav Mahler's Fourth Symphony, second movement. Pat in Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts. Pat, thanks for calling. You're on the air with Norman LeBrecht.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Hi, Pat.
My comment was this. I am conservatory trained as a saxophonist, so I was always around the orchestra, but very, very rarely in it. And, you know, different musicians get excited about different music. The strings would get very excited about playing Beethoven, and the brass would get very excited about playing, you know, Strauss or something. I've never seen an orchestra at any level be nothing but ecstatic to play Mahler.
That's a pretty big thumbs up, and many will be doing it in this anniversary year. We've got the Boston Symphony Orchestra tonight and this weekend under James Levine, and Cedar Rapids, Iowa, and right on Ann Arbor, Michigan's got it coming up, and Washington, Chicago, L.A., New York, Dallas, all in this year in particular playing. Pat, let me ask you, why do you think they're never anything but ecstatic to play Mahler?
I think, especially with younger musicians, which is what I was dealing with, it's some of what your guest is talking about, just it does feel tremendously relevant, and it does bridge both kind of architecturally and sort of socially. I mean, I was listening to your description of the Brahms, and I'm hearing, oh, there's what Shostakovich was doing 20 or 30 years later with, you know, this notion of music as political commentary. Mm-hmm. It's tremendously rousing music. It's very passionate. And at the same time, it feels topical. It feels like, you know, reading, I don't know if you're one of those people that reads War and Peace and says, this is me. It has that kind of sort of grab you by the throat effect.
Pat, I'm so glad for your call.
Pat,
Norman.
Pat, this is Norman LeBrecht. That's very, very apt indeed, and I agree with every word that you've said. It does excite orchestral players, and later on in the program, if we get the time, I want to tell you how it changed the life of one orchestra, how the Tenth Symphony completely changed the life of one orchestral player who was in great trauma. it also unsettles them because it does things. It makes the music come multi-directionally, and sometimes they're hearing things that don't give them the security that a Brahms symphony or a Sibelius symphony gives them. They're on the edge of their seats. They're not quite knowing what's going to come at them next. So that's a big part of it for musicians. The other thing, as you rightly said, the irony that Mahler brought to music enabled Dmitri Shostakovich to describe the tyranny of Soviet Russia and not be sent to the Gulag and not be stood against the wall in the Lubyanka and shot, because irony is impossible to pin down. Irony, in Samuel Johnson's definition, is saying one thing and meaning another. And so by putting irony into music, Mahler enabled composers like Shostakovich to form a one-man resistance against tyranny in the Soviet Union.
Let's hear more. Here's Seventh Symphony, Second Movement, New York Philharmonic, conducted by Mahler's great champion in the United States, Leonard Bernstein. Mahler's Seventh, with its horns calling to each other there as if across mountain valleys in a gathering dusk. Robin in Hampton Road, Virginia. Robin, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi, what do you know, Robin?
Well, I'm just calling to kind of give a horn player's perspective of Mahler's First Symphony. I just finished up my master's work at CCM, and I remember working that opening and how terrifying it can be to come in so beautifully on that D-sharp and lead the orchestra with that theme. And I remember hearing the Cincinnati Symphony Orchestra play it, and all that fear and trepidation just melts away. Mahler is absolutely transcendental. So it is a spiritual experience to get to play it, and even to get to listen to such a wonderful piece of music.
Robin, thanks so much for your call. Norman, it's a good moment for a horn player. They're not the first, but the seventh. And those calling across the valley, how terrific.
That's right. And he leaves the players nowhere to hide. I mean, the adrenaline is shooting all around you as a musician, because you know you are totally exposed. At the opening of the third symphony that we heard, the opening of the seventh, at the opening of the fifth, there is a single naked trumpet who daren't crack a note.
Right.
And it's for musicians, this is absolutely terrifying. The whole orchestra is sitting there on the edge of their seat, praying that the man has got enough, or the woman has got enough breath to blow that trumpet. So he injects that tension into the making of the music, but he's also doing other things. And what we've been hearing here in the Seventh Symphony is the third way that Mahler changed the world. We listen to those horns, and then we heard the music going this way and that way. Where on earth is he taking us? And then drums. What on earth is going on? Where is he taking us? The first person to understand that symphony, and it was extremely perplexing when he gave the first performance in 1908 in Prague, the first person to understand that was Arnold Schoenberg, who was the radical atonalist, the man who tipped music over the cliff edge of tonality and brought us what we think of today as modern sound, as music that's no longer trapped into the relationship between 8 or 12 notes, but which exists in a free space where a composer can do anything. Now, Schoenberg understood that Mahler is the key to opening the door away from the strictures and the confines of the 18th and the 19th centuries, and to bring us into the modern technological age, to bring music into our lives.
There's Mahler as the bridge, Mahler as the key. Norman LeBrecht is with us from London. His new book is Why Mahler, How One Man and Ten Symphonies Changed Our World. We'll go out of this segment with a little more. Seventh Symphony, Fourth Movement, Leonard Bernstein, New York Philharmonic. You can join us as Mahler changed your world. Do you have you performed Mahler? What work and what do you feel in the midst of it? 800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about composer Gustav Mahler 150 years after his birth. Here's the final movement from Mahler's Song of the Earth, sung here in 1967 by soprano Christa Ludwig. This is the 150th anniversary year of Gustav Mahler's birth. Next year, the 100th of his death. He lived only to 50. Norman Lebrecht is with us this hour from London. His new book is Why Mahler, How One Man and Ten Symphonies Changed Our World. You can join us, 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Norman, lots of response here online. I'm not sure this first applies most to this particular piece of music, but Alan writes, What bothers me about Mahler's music is what I see as an undisciplined musicianship. He dilutes his power by a lack of organization and structure. At the same time, there are parts that I love. And then Vanessa writes, as a professional opera singer who sings and loves, all caps, Mahler's songs, I grieve for the fact that he never wrote full operas. His song cycles are beautifully written for the voice, full of drama and spirit. How is it he never wrote an opera? What about those two observations, Norman?
Well, Mahler leaves nobody indifferent. You either, even those who love him are occasionally up in arms at something that he's done. He's always disturbing you. He never leaves you complacent, whether you're a listener or a musician. You're always somehow being challenged by him. And he never wrote an opera because opera was his day job. He was director of an opera house. So he separated the two, his creative side, his inventive side, which was the symphonies, and what he was trying to do in the reform of the opera house, in trying to drag opera, kicking and screaming, into the modern age, drag it away from the control of singers and make it into the complete experience that his idol Richard Wagner had always dreamed of. Now, the Song of the Earth, which we just heard, begins from the summer that Mahler's life falls apart. It's the summer of 1907, and he's decided after 10 years to give up his job in Vienna because the pressures are just too great. He's fed up with the attacks on him, many of them racially based. He realizes that the thing that he's been trying to do, the complete work of art in opera is non-perfectible, and he's done all he could. So he gives up his job at the opera house, and then two terrible things happen. His five-year-old child falls sick with diphtheria and is dead within a week.
One of two daughters, just two children.
One of two daughters. And when the doctor comes round to look after his wife, Alma, who is suffering, as he is, from the bereavement, he takes a look at Mahler and says, I don't like what I'm hearing in your heart. I suspect endocarditis. Mm-hmm. You could drop dead at any time. And the diagnosis was, in fact, accurate. He had heart damage, heart valve damage, mm-hmm. that stems from rheumatic fever as a child. He's 47 years old, and he's received a death sentence. So his life is completely transformed in that summer, and these terrible dark clouds are overhead. He doesn't know what he's going to be able to do with himself. And it's at this point that he discovers 8th century Chinese poetry of the Ming Dynasty, poets like Li Bao, who's still tremendously important in Chinese culture and civilization. Five-year-old, six-year-old children in China know him and recite him to me. And out of that, he creates the Song of the Earth. And he starts to put his life together. He goes to America. America, the Met, the Metropolitan Opera in New York, mm-hmm. offers him a job as a conductor. He doesn't have to direct anything. He doesn't have to run the business. They offer him a job for 6 months at five times as much as he was getting in Vienna. And he thought, well, yeah. You know, at least I can leave my wife and daughter a little bit of a pension.
Mm-hmm. And off he went.
And off he went. And then he comes to America for four consecutive seasons, mm-hmm. With his wife and on occasion with his daughter, and having been pushed out of the Met by an ambitious younger colleague called Arturo Toscanini, mm-hmm. he then takes on the New York Philharmonic Orchestra and creates what we know today as the modern concert season. The subscription series, that begins with Mahler. The educational series, that begins with Mahler. Contemporary music in the middle of a concert program, that begins with Mahler. He completely revolutionizes the concert hall. But his life is not easy, and it's not happy, and his wife, who is 19 years younger than him, is very, very unsettled in the marriage. And in the summer of 1910, she takes a lover.
Famous lover.
A famous lover. Well, he's not quite famous yet. At that time, he's just a very, very handsome Prussian young man of 28, a man of her own age, and his name is Walter Gropius. Mm-hmm. And
Bauhaus.
He's going to be the founder of the Bauhaus. Mm-hmm. He's going to be the founder of the Bauhaus. He's going to do for architecture what Arnold Schoenberg did for music. He's going to make us look at buildings completely anew. And she is in the throes of this passionate affair with a young man. And Mahler, discovering the affair, writes his 10th symphony. He feels he's a semi-invalid. He's been ordered to give up the vigorous exercise that he's always felt is essential to getting the oxygen running mm-hmm. in his brain and getting his creative spirits flowing. And he writes this 10th symphony, which is one of the great documents of despair and resistance in the whole of Western civilization. It would be very easy for someone at that time to succumb to self-pity. There's no self-pity in the symphony. The clues that we get of what he's going through actually come on the manuscript, where he's writing, he's scrawling exclamations to his wife, saying, you alone know what this means. Without you, I cannot live.
Let us hear it. Let us hear a bit from it. We've got it right here, if we may,
yes.
Norman. We've got
great,
it.
Yes,
Tenth
lovely.
Symphony, fourth movement, written during a time, as Norman LaBrush says, of great personal stress. He just realized Alma was having this particular affair. It wasn't the first. Here, the fourth movement, grave and sinister, considered by some to be Mahler's last horror scherzo. Mahler's 10th symphony there, the Berlin Philharmonic, conducted by Simon Rattle. Celine in Boston. Celine, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you.
Yes.
I've loved him all my life, but had a romance with Mahler, tempered by having heard that his wife Alma was also a composer, and that early on Mahler told her to abandon her career as a composer. Is this an urban myth, or is it in fact true? If it's true, could you please discuss it a bit, the circumstances, why he, as an artistic intellectual, could ask such a sacrifice of his partner?
Yes, we will. And on top of that, Norman, maybe the notion of her affairs as revenge for that request, which in fact is historically true.
Yes, depending on interpretation. Celine, is it?
Yes, please.
Who asked the question. Mm-hmm. Celine, this is partly true and partly feminist mythology. What happened was this. Mahler was 41 when he met a young woman of 22 called Alma Schindler, and he fell in love with her and he wanted to marry her, and she told him she was also a musician. She was writing these songs. They'd never been performed, they'd never been sung, they'd certainly never been published, but she also wanted to be a composer. He at this time
not is easy for a woman in those years to be performed, right?
Not easy, but she wasn't yet a composer. She wasn't even a terribly good student. And he is director of the opera. He's the second most famous man in Vienna after the emperor. And he's also a composer who's starting to become really famous with the symphonies. And he says to her, look, and it's a famous letter, and it's a really very, very moving letter. And I think many of us have had these conversations with our partners at the moment that we're about to settle into marriage, or in the early years of marriage, when we say that in a certain field, one of us has to take the lead. If there's two of us, it's going to rock the ship. It's going to unsettle it. He said to her, look, there are an awful lot of people out to get me. And if they start to perform your music, which I've looked at, which I don't think is very good, if they start to perform your music, they're going to praise it at my expense. They're going to build you at my expense. They're going to use you as a weapon against me, and our marriage is going to fail. So I'm asking you, please, if you want to marry me, just give up composing for the time being. There will come a time where you can compose, and I'll be perfectly happy with that. Later on, during the crisis in their marriage, when she seemed to be about to leave him for Gropius, he looked at the songs again. He said, look, I'll help you to get them published. I'll help you to get them performed. They're maybe not as bad as I thought all those years ago. The proof that they really aren't any good, or aren't much good, is firstly, look at them, listen to them, and you can hear that any of the original ideas actually come from Alma's teacher, whose name is Alexander Zelensky.
You know, Norman, I have to interject. You say you call it a feminist myth, but it sounds like the feminist complaint. The husband says, put yours aside, stand aside, here I go.
Well, you know, but Tom, I mean, you know, when any of us get married, the other party always says to us, I want you to leave behind this part of your life. I want you to change this part of yourself.
I don't know
marriage
about
is
that.
Always marriage.
That sounds
well,
like
it didn't happen. It didn't. Let's not get too personal here. Yeah. But I mean, it's there are certain things that my wife said to me you know, there are certain ways that you have to change and adapt to living with another person.
Were her affairs revenge for what she lost, Norman?
I don't think so. No, mm-hmm. I think there was sexual unhappiness in the marriage. There was also a deep trauma within her. She adored her father. She'd lost him at the age of 12. She saw in Mahler a replacement for her father, and she really was emotionally a bit of a mess. But just to put the cap on the question of Mahler suppressing her creativity, after Mahler died, we didn't see any great rush of composing from Alma. It never mattered that much to her. It mattered to her in her memoirs when she made a big thing of it. So, oh, you know, he kept me in a box. Mm. But if she was a real composer, the moment the so-called ban was lifted, one would have heard a lot more from her. She would have gone out. She would have composed. She didn't. And she said of herself, and she says of herself in her diaries, I was never a really creative personality. I could be the inspiration. I could be the muse to famous men and to famous partners. And she had several famous partners after Mahler. Mm. But in myself, I always knew I never had that spark. So the idea that Mahler in some way suppressed her, that's a myth.
Norman, I don't think you're going to win a feminist parade with that, but we've got the perspective. Ken, not at all. Fort Erie, Ontario. Ken, you're on the air with Norman Lebrecht.
Well, hello. It's a wonderful program, and I thank Mr. Lebrecht for his insights and enthusiasm. I've learned a great deal. I did want to point out that the Viennese audience had heard something similar to the opening of the Titan, because it's the same opening.
The first symphony.
As Beethoven's Ninth. Mm-hmm. Same A.
You are so right. You're so right, Tom.
I just needed to point that out.
You are so right. But here's the big difference. Beethoven is a famous composer. He's an established composer, and he starts his Ninth Symphony with that kind of fluttering effect. But he doesn't run it for more than about 25 seconds. Mahler, a complete unknown, runs it for 4.5 minutes.
Well, I'd also have to disagree because there's a theme that comes in, da, 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 which is, yep, is Beethoven's fourth. And so it's another, if you go to Beethoven's fourth, I believe that's the opening theme of the first movement. And so it's not running quite as long as you say. I would have to just make, you know, that's a little cavil.
It's a very good point that you make it.
Yeah, well, check out Beethoven's fourth as well, the beginning, and you'll see it's a similar...
You're absolutely right, and Mahler is teasing you with it. He's saying, am I going to take you down a Beethoven route? Woo! No.
Ken, you're a pro, and we're very grateful for your call. Our time is so short. One more comment from listener John on Facebook who writes, if we could set to music the innermost stirrings of our minds with all our fears and hopes, it would sound like Mahler. That's pretty much your point, Norman LeBash.
I think it is. You know, why Mahler? Why does he affect us in the way that he does? Why do we turn to him in moments of our deepest stress and our deepest exaltation? He does seem to be the composer of our times. I'm coming on book tour to the United States next month. I don't have a date in Boston yet, but I'd love to come there. And just to see, just to try and engage with people, as we've been doing on this show, to hear why it is that they feel this extraordinary sense of ownership over Mahler. Everybody feels that Mahler is somehow his or her private and most intimate possession. Mm. That Mahler has touched us in ways that nobody else does.
We will go out of this wonderful hour with a Jesse Norman, renowned soprano, singing Mahler's signature Lieder song, I'm Lost to the World. Ich bin der Welt abandoned gekommen.
It's the ultimate contradiction in Mahler. He's writing a song here that says, I'm untouchable, I'm lost to the world. You can throw all the slings and arrows that you like at me. You can't get me. I live in my own cocoon. At the particular moment that he's writing it, he has just fallen madly in love with his future wife, Alma. The contradiction is innate and inherent in Mahler. And what he does is he asks each and every one of us to interpret that within our own lives.
And now we know what will come. Thanks again to the Boston University Music Library for so much of the music today. Norman LeBrecht's new book is Why Mahler, How One Man and Ten Symphonies Changed Our World. Norman LeBrecht in London, thank you so much for your time and insights today.
Tom, it's been an enormous pleasure.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. We go out with Mahler. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.